As usual, I turned on my little transistor radio so I could hear the news while I ate breakfast. A selection of classical music was playing. When it ended, the commentator said, "Of course, you recognize that as the Biafra national anthem." I shouted for Godfrey. He came running in from the small kitchen, alarmed at my unexpected cry. "Biafra," I shouted, pointing to the radio. He looked puzzled, smiled, and said, "Sir?"
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A.
Sometime in the late 1960s, the world learned a dreadful new word in a very poignant way. The word was kwashiorkor. It was an appalling consequence of malnutrition, and its principal victims were children, whose gaunt, emaciated bodies were topped with hair of an eerie orange hue, and whose haunted eyes bespoke the anguish of their condition. Kwashiorkor became the symbol of the Biafran War, the secessionist struggle that pitted a region of Nigeria against the central government. Like most wars, its main casualties were civilians, and its consequences may be with us yet. My guest today is John Sherman, author of War Stories, a memoir of Nigeria and Biafra. John Sherman, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
You arrived, John Sherman, in Nigeria as a Peace Corps volunteer in September of 1966. And within a month of your arrival, there was an extraordinary, awful massacre of Igbo tribesmen in the north of the country. You were at that time, I think, in the east,
yes,
the Igbo region.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of that massacre, tensions heightened, and the momentum toward rebellion was underway. As an arriving Westerner, did you sense immediately the depth of ethnic tension? What was the atmosphere like? I mean, were you sort of caught up in something you felt was impending toward violence?
Well, it was part of a continuum, really, because in 1966 there had been two coups. And for many reasons, they pitted different groups against one another. And so the latest one had been in July of that year. So this was just a few months after that. We were well aware. We had a good Peace Corps training, so we were well aware of what was taking place and had taken place and reasons for that. Obviously, we were very pro-Eastern region at that time, later pro-Biafran. So this was a situation where it certainly ramped up the tensions, of course, and really became de facto secession after that pogrom.
Right. I suppose this question may have some degree of self-evidence to it, but were those passions orchestrated? I mean, I have the sense of a deep, long-lasting animosity amongst the various groups there that had exploded in this kind of environment. But was there some degree of masterminding to this?
Very much so. As a journalism major, it was fascinating to watch. And now I work in PR, but I wasn't at that time. Mm-hmm. But the PR campaign on the side of the Biafrans, earlier the those from east in the region, was wonderful as far as being masterful. The Nigerians never did quite catch up, and I later, during the war, when I was back there, and the subject of the book, of course, was surprised and shocked that at their ineptness in terms of capturing the world opinion.
The Nigerians.
The Nigerians. Mm-hmm. The Biafrans did a great job of doing that.
Mm-hmm. This may be, I know this is superficial, but it's one of the impressions I drew from my memory of that time. The Biafrans are largely the Igbo tribe. And they were reputed, and I still have this in memory, as being very industrious, kind of ingenious, energetic people. And when you make a point about them being adept at publicity, it seems to fit.
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. One of the chief reasons for the pogrom, in fact, was that they controlled many jobs in the northern region. The northern region was and is less educated. It's predominantly Muslim. They would take over jobs in banks and post offices and civil service jobs and private industry. And when an opening came up, as much as they could, they would bring up a cousin or brother and so forth.
Right.
It's not that other people, other places, other times haven't done this, but they had it perfected to a science.
Mm-hmm.
So openings for a person in the area were virtually non-existent. So great resentment had built up.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other main ethnic groups of Nigeria, as I recall, the Yoruba.
Yoruba,
and
yes.
And the Hausa, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. The Yoruba are primarily in the western region. They are both Muslim and Christian. Mm-hmm. They extend somewhat into the small Midwest region. I still think of those regions, right. Although there are many states today. And the Hausas and Fulanis and others, the Hausas are the main mm-hmm. group in the north.
Yes. And this is something I've sort of wondered about for 30 years. In the context of the war itself, John Sherman, was it the Igbo against everyone? Had these other groups sort of massed against the Igbo? Was it the central government sort of drawing its strength from those other ethnic groups? And
well, in a sense, of course, the Igbos were the predominant group in the East. There were many other groups there. I mean, the area I lived in, although most of my students at my boarding school were Igbos, mm-hmm. actually the area was what they called a minority area. Mm-hmm. And these were what they called Rivers people, their Rivers region, section, and so forth. But so it wasn't quite as cut and dry. That's what I felt even when I went back. Mm-hmm. And then Northern soldiers would be wearing crucifixes because they were Christians, and there were many people in the former East who were not Igbos, who were either supporting the war because they felt they had no choice, or right. because they really did believe in it. So there was it was fairly. Yeah. Igbo against the rest of the country, but not quite, yeah.
Port Harcourt is the central city, is that correct, of the Igbo region?
It's the main port city. The central area would probably be Enugu, which was mm-hmm. the capital of the region, or Owerri was a big one.
Right. And, I associate those cities, I guess Port Harcourt most in at least my memory and imagination, as considerably rich in terms of resources. Is that correct? Is it a region that has much to...
Yes, well, ironically, the... Oil-producing regions in the East, or the former East, are almost entirely not in Igbo lands, but mm-hmm. they were controlled by the central government of the East and the later Biafra, which was virtually all right. Igbo. So that you had a lot of areas near Port Harcourt. I lived about 2 or 3 miles from my school. I was about 70 miles from Port Harcourt, and we had a huge refinery, Shell BP refinery, mm-hmm. about 3 miles away. I'd ride my bike over there and look around. It was all bombed during the war and so forth. A lot of oil is still produced out of that region, both onshore and offshore.
Right. You know, one of the things that's striking in your book, John Sherman, which is very much, as you advertise it, even in the subtitle, a personal memoir mm-hmm. of all that took place, is your very striking and strong sympathy for Biafra, as I understood it. I mean, both at the beginning and even at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And when I read that and I thought about it, I said, well, you know, civil wars are not uncommon. We've had our own in this country. And one of the most often cited reasons for engaging in them is to keep the country united. But you had a strong feeling, I think, about the need for Biafran independence. Why was that?
Because I knew so many people. It was the first time and maybe the last time that I was so personally involved right. that when I went away, we were evacuated, and I spent a year in Malawi right. finishing up the Peace Corps. But there was a huge distraction that whole year because we followed the news. We got the New York Times weekly edition and listened to the radio and the BBC and so forth and followed the growing situation where these stories now became about the children. You mentioned Kwashiorkor, about the children dying from this, about the, you know, civilian casualties, the hospitals being bombed and all these kinds of things going on and really just captured the world's imagination, captured their heart and made them angry and mm-hmm. sad. And they contributed to various relief right. groups. So it was a question of being so personally attached to it that mm-hmm. I felt a real need to do something.
Right. I'm going to probe that personal attachment because that's really the spirit of the book. Before I do that, though, I want to address something that's as current as today's headlines, but which is brought out in all that you went through and all that you saw in the Biafran situation. I'm referring to tribal conflict, ethnic conflict. As you and I both know, even today, the Congo, the eastern Congo, is almost aflame with it. I could mm-hmm. mention Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, Congo, and so forth. Did you draw any larger conclusions, John Sherman, about why these kinds of conflicts break out with such tragic frequency in Africa?
I can't pinpoint anything to Africa in particular. Certainly, some of the colonial powers, and we can't lay the blame always on the colonial powers, mm-hmm. but the British were adept at divide and rule, and they were... rather a perfectionist in that, and certainly use that in Nigeria and other places where they pitted one group against another for their greater common good to rule a country, use this. And so one of the reasons perhaps that there were so many Igbos working in the north was that the British had encouraged that kind of thing.
Right.
They were well-educated. They were eager. They were able to bring in more people. And so that sort of situation, you know, was something mm-hmm. that they had developed early on and was continuing. there's so many different groups that were divided when they drew the map in Berlin in the 1880s and literally got the ruler out and drew the lines. They didn't care if they went right through the middle of an ethnic group. So they divided so that some people in Togo are closer related to some people in Ghana, and yet there was this border, and there was the Anglophone, Francophone division and things like that. So you had people really thrown apart as well as thrown together who were traditional enemies many times.
And had
no reason to really get along, as they could see.
Well, actually, that's an excellent answer, because the borders of Africa are, as we both know, problematic. And you also suggest the importance of history and the need, perhaps, for the rest of the world to pay more attention to what history has created in Africa. Let's get right to your personal experience, John, because it's fascinating. At the time things broke out in Nigeria, you were, as you just mentioned, evacuated to Malawi, along with the rest of the Peace Corps contingent, I'm sure. But you made, and this is what the book hinges on, a personal decision to return. Now, you mentioned your personal attachment to the region, but you were actually going back into harm's way, so maybe there's even more to it. What compelled you to sort of make a 180-degree turn and go right back into the thick of it?
Well, I'd like to blame Frédéric Chopin, first of all.
That's an original answer.
I was sitting at the dining table in my house. It was a day school in Malawi.
All right.
And one of the French volunteers had left, a new one had come in. They were militaires, and he was a lover of classical music, as I am. So he was playing some Chopin piece. I wish I knew now what it was. And I had kind of thought about doing this, and I had come close to a year's service in Malawi. I was supposed to stay until the end of the calendar year, even though that would have made it more than 2 years if that was the agreement. But I thought, well, to heck with it. So I... So I was sitting there, and the music was just swelling up, and I was listening to it, and I was thinking about these things, and we'd seen all these photos, and I'd heard all these stories, and I was not in touch with anyone because they were fleeing from the war. And it's what I call one of those pure moments in your life when you decide, this is what I'm going to do no matter what.
Yeah.
And I made the decision right in the middle of whatever movement it was that he was playing.
You know, actually, that's very understandable. I mean, I can just see the emotional power that really swept you up. I mean, based, of course, on your previous experience, it was all building. But I can imagine that moment, even as you tell us about it. Now, in going back there, and it's a very interesting point you make, upon your arrival, there's this confrontation, if you will, kind of low-key way with these customs types or military types in Nigeria. It was intimidating, I thought, and kind of frightening. I mean, at that moment, did you have second thoughts about it, or what?
No, not second thoughts at all. The only thing that really frightened me was that I had lied on the form and said that I had not been there before, because I thought, if they say, where were you and when were you there, they wouldn't let me in.
Right.
And then I already had my Nigerian visa stamped on my passport, and I thought, I'll be found out, and now I can't go to Biafra because I can't get in. So.
But you didn't go to Biafra, actually, because to do that, you would have had to take that circuitous route through Fernando Po and then come back.
Exactly.
In. And you end up in Nigeria.
Yes.
Serving
yes.
there and helping the helpless, right. the victims of the war there. And that's an interesting thing, too, because as we said earlier, your sympathies clearly were with a free or an independent Biafra. But I guess it was, or I pose it as a question, was it the suffering that you saw in Nigeria that said, well, look, suffering is suffering? I mean, you just...
Yes, it was that. It was also just the futility of war that just really had an impact on me. And I saw that, you know, I knew that at that point, or we were pretty sure at that point, that Biafra was not going to succeed. When we were evacuated from Biafra, I think most of us were convinced that they were going to succeed and we might even go back and that they would make it happen. They were very confident, of course, and that was one of the reasons that they declared secession, one of the reasons that people were so, within that new country, were so supportive of it. So in working back there, it was so depressing to see that all the children in particular were suffering, the other civilians were suffering. Everything was just the infrastructure was just totally gone. I drove into Port Harcourt, which was at that time had been a city of about 175,000 people, and it was like being at a Fellini movie. I'm driving along, and there is absolutely no one on the streets. I don't mean one or two people. Right. I mean no one. You drove for miles into the center of the city, and the only people there were a handful of Red Cross people and soldiers, pretty much concentrated in one area.
Right.
And these were streets I was familiar with from almost not being able to get through. It was just chaotic and packed and crammed and so forth with lorries and taxis and everything else. And you could hear your tires crunching along the street. You know,
because they were so empty.
Yes.
Yeah. That's striking, too. You know, it's really interesting to me. I think every reader who reads a book, and if you think about the books you've read, even years later, there's one thing that sticks with you, if it's really made an impression on you. And I'm sure that one of the things that's going to stick with me from your book is the degree of suffering among civilian populations, children in particular. I mean, page after page, it seems to me that that was one of the things you must have been deeply affected by.
Yes, very much so, very much so. And I was working as a, what you'd really call a pharmacist, dispensing the medicine, which on the surface of things was pretty scary with my science background being so lacking.
Better you than me.
They trained me well, and I was very careful. But so we'd work with interpreters, and I would either force feed medicine to the children right there on the bench, or we would or we would give them medicine to take back to the village, because we came to each clinic once a week.
Right.
And there was a great feeling that so many of those children would not make it through the week, that they were simply too far gone.
Yeah.
It was extremely debilitating for me, because we saw the worst kids first, of course, the worst people, and they were mostly children. So one after another, minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day, clinic after clinic, this is almost all the people that I personally treated. And they did, as you described, they had these obvious signs of it, and or you saw it beginning to show up in them, and you hope that the next week they would be improved, and you had no way of knowing who was who. There were so many, so you didn't know if they came back or not, but sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't.
Right. Now we're getting right into the work, and this, I think, is another, probably the central point in the entire book. You are with a small team. I remember Inga and Olive, is it?
The
nurse's embrace was
right.
The doctor. And I got a very strong sense of commitment and really quite wonderfulness, if that's a word, among the women in particular impressed me, the two nurses and as you yourself. But beyond that, maybe this is my main point, this is the first book I've ever read about a war that did not dwell on the political community or the military community, but rather on the humanitarian community. In other words, this is my first insight into that reality, and maybe for many people reading the book, that'll be the truth. And it led to this question. It seemed a very eclectic group. I'm talking about the larger picture now, beyond your own team. I mean, there were, and from brief depictions, I got the sense of some people were there for very good motives. Others, it might have been more problematic, and there was a great deal of confusion. It was a very mixed picture. Is that a correct impression?
Yes, I think so. Yes, yes, I had. Did not have a great love for the Red Cross, even though I was working for the Red Cross. And I shouldn't say just damning them all, but to technically be a member of the ICRC, the International Committee, you have to be a Swiss citizen. And so many of them came out from Geneva and other places. And I was not that impressed with their understanding of Africa, with their concern. They seemed to be, and I was very flippant in saying this in the book, but I think it's accurate, escaping, boring marriages and boring jobs and just coming out for the adventure of things. I thought they were racist. I thought that they were inept in many ways, that they were so concerned with paperwork. They had so much paperwork that even at my level, I had to compile numbers and so on. And I understand you want to know how many people you're feeding and so on. But that seemed to be the primary reason, and as opposed to the humanitarian side of things.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, John Sherman, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is John Sherman, author of War Stories, a memoir of Nigeria and Biafra. John, let me see if I can, in the space of a few sentences, give you some more impressions of your experiences recounted in the book and in the context of the war itself. And the first word that occurred to me was surreal.
Yes.
Surreal in many ways. And I should point out, stylistically, the book contrasts in italics, what I thought were some of your earlier experiences as a volunteer with the later experiences of the war itself. Mm-hmm. So it makes it even more surreal in a sense. We see, for example, appalling medical problems, which you've just cited, random military brutality. You almost don't know what to expect at any roadblock. Mm-hmm. Conflicted humanitarian operations in the sense that I remember there's one flight where you're going to take aid material in on a plane that arms material have just gone out on, or something like that. Mad generals, one in particular, who seems a very frightening figure, and cowed civilians. Now, that's a very brief shorthand for a lot of experience. But I wonder, first of all, what was it like? I mean, that's kind of a banal question, but the experience of living in a daily way, day by day, day after day, and with this kind of Fellini-esque reality mm-hmm. around you. What mm-hmm. does it do to you?
Well, I think surreal is certainly a key word. Mm-hmm. I think that we felt that certainly at the time, and I've given obviously a lot of thought to it since and feel very much the same way. It was in some ways a job where you got up and you went to work and you did things, you came home and you rested and you had dinner and you replenished the supplies and you went out again the next day. Mm-hmm. But that belies the fact of how surreal or bizarre, whatever it was. And it was a situation that you never really got used to it. You never really adjusted to it. You never really numbed by it. It wasn't something that any of us just broke down and cried or thought through it at the time. You really didn't have time for that, mm-hmm. and you didn't want to really push those emotions to the foreground. You had a job to do, and you were there to take care of things. It was only afterwards mm-hmm. that I just sort of made up for lost time and mm-hmm. just really, you know, mm-hmm. Lost it and mm-hmm. And cried. And certainly it's been a feeling with me very, very often since then.
Yeah.
Where you think back on it or you see a certain situation that triggers something that, because without even having written the book, it's something that stays with you very, very much and never goes away.
That's meaningful. As a matter of fact, if I may say so, when you describe it that way, you sound very much like a soldier, actually.
I mean, yes.
It's kind of the same in battle.
Well, and I thought of that when they started talking about this delayed syndrome that mm-hmm.
Traumatic men from stress disorder.
Yes, mm-hmm. the men from Vietnam mm-hmm. have. And I think it's very similar. Mm-hmm. And I think that the people with whom I were working, I'm sure, have had many of the same feelings, that
right.
it's things just really never go away. You always remember that. You remember the children. You remember them rushing a soldier into you that was just, you know, almost dead, you know, covered with blood and this kind of thing.
You know, a memoir, by definition, is a collection of incidents, of events, impressions, one after another. Let me just choose one. As, unfortunately, we come to near the conclusion of this conversation, I really recommend the book. People should get the fuller sense of things. But here's one choice, of personal choice on my part. There is a point where you are taking a young mother back to her village with her dead child, a baby. And you're under instructions to not go into the village, but to come close to it. But don't take that last stretch because it's mined, or I guess it's dangerous. Uh-huh. And you do that. But as you do that, and she leaves the vehicle, looking through the words of the book, you get the impression she looks at you she's disappointed, certainly, hurt, perhaps, maybe even angry. I don't know. And it seemed to me that incident, in a way, sort of brought all the sacrifice and the frustration of the kind of work you're doing into focus. What were your feelings at that moment?
Oh, that's probably the one piece in the book that is the sharpest for me, and that I could not read aloud for a long time because I would start to tear up and so on, because I remember it so well. I wanted to drive her those last few miles. She was holding her dead baby, her only child, that I had carried for her and given to her in the Land Rover. And yet, because of the possibility of mines, which was a real possibility, we wouldn't have known, I couldn't do that. We knew we were safe on the main paved road, but this was a village road going back 3 or 4 miles. And her lack of English and my lack of Igbo kept us from really communicating that way. But she also, she tried to assure me this was okay. And I felt horrible. I felt so guilty about it because here there was this horrible thing in her life. And yet I sort of bumped her out of the vehicle and just said, make your way home. And she just thought I was being lazy. I know she always thought I was just selfish and like I didn't want to drive down this road, stop here and just make your way home, you know.
Right.
And I felt very, what I said, I say in the book that it sort of made me a little insane. It's one of those things that really bothered you.
Right. Well, in the end, John Sherman, by 1970, Biafra is vanquished, reincorporated into Nigeria. The war is over. Hundreds of thousands, as you point out, perhaps even millions, the count really isn't known, are dead. So I guess 3 decades later, the question is, you know, what was it all about? What's left? I mean, is Biafran sentiment still alive? And I'm intrigued by that because I went to the internet and I saw some Biafran websites.
Yes, it is. In fact, to me, even surprisingly so, that it's almost like, I don't know, someone likened it to a U.S. Confederate kind of feeling, you know, even though these people are remember the time. It's not that they're talking about their ancestors. Ojukwu is back in Nigeria. He was the head of Eastern Region, then the head of Biafra, the only head. who fled at almost the last moment, literally went to the Ivory Coast for some years, and then was one of the people running for president in this last election. Mm-hmm. And I have real problems with that, that he's sort of back and kind of exonerated, and you know, life goes on for him. He's not the only one to say that about, but certainly great deal of just alone the physical damage. You know, just whole infrastructures were destroyed, buildings were destroyed, roadways and all kinds of things that had to be repaired and replaced and so on. Let alone, as you said, you know, and I wrote that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people died. Most of those, I would guess, would be civilians. You also have a great many people, those children who were quite ill, who did survive, but who were so incapacitated that they were not able to have full lives after that and may have had a short lifespan or may still be alive today but are not able to really lead a normal life. You know, they're mentally and perhaps even physically handicapped. So those impacts very, very much so are still there.
And I can't think of a more apt concluding question for the conversation than the effects on John Sherman. And I'm mindful, as I mentioned that the tears you withheld in Biafra you shed in Rome on your way back, the book, as you get new clothes and sort of divest yourself of your Biafran raiment, so to speak, you collapse in tears in a hotel in Rome, and then go out to the opera, maybe. Well, not Chopin didn't do any operas, but that's what that might have set off.
Right.
But clearly, John, this book is also a coda for you to that. And what kind of meaning does it have? Or why did you write the book?
I wrote it for myself. And that sounds maybe very flippant or very pompous or something, but I really did. I felt that I had to take my diaries, which were very mundane. It was like, we did this, we went here, we went there, because we were afraid to write down our feelings and to write down a lot of information because it could have been seized and we could have been in trouble. So I had to take that and then from memory, which was very sharp, it's still pretty sharp about this time, and write the emotional side of things and bring all that in and fill in the gaps, as it were, and make it into this kind of memoir from just a straight diary. It was done as a kind of catharsis. I said to someone before, I'm not sure if semi-cathartic is even a contradiction in terms, but it's sort of that way. It never leaves you. That's the semi part of it. But it certainly was, for me, an experience to get it out and draw it out. I also wrote it because I wanted people to know about it or to remember it, pretty much to know about it. You have to be a certain age to even remember this and then to tell people about this. And hopefully the message of war is futile might get to a few people at least who read this.
Well done, John Sherman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was John Sherman, author of War Stories, a memoir of Nigeria and Biafra. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.